You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's my very great pleasure to welcome you to this RSA lunchtime event today, looking at the human era and how it shapes our planet. And it's my very great pleasure to welcome on that subject Christian Schwegel, whose new book, The Anthropocene, is published in this country this week and sets out some of the thinking that's emerging in different places as to this new phenomenon that's being talked about among the scientific community and increasingly amongst commentators and activists around the concept of the Anthropocene. The Anthropocene is a proposed new geological era, and nobody in the room will be surprised that it's not every day that we announce a new one of those. But the scientific community is on the verge of potentially doing exactly that next year, as evidence being gathered through different disciplines tells us about the profound impact of humankind on the Earth. And the profundity of that impact is perhaps underlined by the fact that it would mark the end of the previous geological era, of course, the Holocene, which started about 12,500 years ago, and of course is the period in which all of agriculture, all of urbanization took place, leading to the rise of our global economy and the civilizations that we live within today. What might the Anthropocene mean in terms of reframing the human future? So the conditions that will come with the Anthropocene, of course, are not simply a technical and scientific subject. They're also highly political, philosophical, and about the relationship that we wish to foster with the Earth into the future. A great many questions raised by this new idea. I'm going to invite Christian now to share with us some of his thoughts that have emerged through his thinking and writing on this subject. Then we'll spend a bit of time in discussion, and then we'll come to the floor and involve the rest of the room in the conversation. Christian, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Tony. It's wonderful to be here. I'm greatly honored to be in this very inspirational institution. And it's a perfect day for this topic in particular, as you will see in a minute. Just briefly about myself, I'm a biologist by training. I'm a journalist and a book author. I've worked for German publications like Der Spiegel and Frankfurter Allgemeine newspaper as a correspondent. And I now work freelance, which gives me the chance of exploring this amazing topic more deeply together with cultural institutions in my country, Germany. Now, the Anthropocene is certainly not my idea. It's an idea that has been formulated by this man. His name is Paul Crutzen. Paul Crutzen's been born in the Netherlands in 1930, and he has received a training as a civil engineer. He built bridges in Amsterdam in the 1950s after the war. But he always wanted to become a natural scientist. It was just the war didn't allow him to pursue that education. He then went to Sweden to build houses. And in Sweden, he didn't feel happy with building houses. He kept being curious about the natural sciences. So one day in the local newspaper, he read an ad from the Institute of Meteorology and the Stockholm University asking for a computer expert. Now, he had no idea about meteorology, and he had no idea about computers, but something told him he should apply. And as you might know, he got the job. And he became one of the leading atmospheric scientists in the world and paved the way to the realization that there are substances that can harm the ozone layer of our planet. And this research contributed to these substances being at least partly banned and to the fact that the ozone layer now is regenerating and we can walk around freely without being too concerned about UV radiation. And this made Paul Crutzen realize that humankind is not the small force that is just scratching the surface of Earth, but it's something bigger that is happening. So Paul Crutzen started making a list of interventions, of changes that our species has caused on this planet, which is 4.5 billion years old, And we have all the treasures that have been built up over this time with us now, but we are using them in a way that is detrimental to our own species. So Paul, in the year 2000, at a scientific meeting in Mexico, when there was talk about the Holocene again and again, he stood up and said, we are not living in this Holocene, this abstract word, Holocene anymore. We live, and he looked for a word, we live in the Anthropocene. And this only now, 15 years ago, was the start of this amazing idea. He wrote together with Eugene Sturmer, who was a biologist in the United States, who also had come up with this idea. He then got together with Eugene Sturmer and wrote a paper formalizing or introducing the idea to the scientific community. Now, what have we now, after 15 years, and this is amazing, today's cover story of Nature magazine is about the Anthropocene. So this idea really is taking off now. It is something science looks into very deeply. And this is a fascinating paper that has just come out today. And last night I had the honor to share the floor with Jan Salasiewicz, who is the head of the Anthropocene Working Group, a formal scientific body looking into the physical evidence of a new geological epoch or era. What it is will still be decided. Now, this group will have the job to find physical markers to show that we are, as a species, influencing, changing the course of Earth's history. And I mean, this really says something, that we are opening a new chapter in this record book of Earth's history we are keeping. So the Anthropocene would be at least a new subchapter. And you can see a lot of the physical evidence Jan Salasiewicz's group is trying to put together. These are things like the number of the million kilometers of tunnels we have been digging in the underground, making perhaps us look like a large worm to some future scientists who might in 100,000 years try and figure out what has been going on Earth. So you have the mines, the tunnels. You have the rise in the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, in the oceans. You have a global spread of animals and plants. We've been transporting between the continents for centuries now, which are mixing up the global ecosystem. You have nitrogen flow greatly changed by the Haber-Bosch process. 40% of us in the room, and I leave it to you to decide if you want to be part of that 40% or not, of that 40% or not, are alive because of the Haber-Bosch process that allows us to isolate nitrogen from the atmosphere and turn it into fertilizer. That has been something that's been making our modern life possible. But now there is more nitrogen in the ecosystems, brought into the ecosystems by the Haber-Bosch process, than had been in the ecosphere before. And so there's this amazingly long list of indicators that will be used to delineate the Anthropocene from the Holocene. And it looks in geology very orderly. This is the geological timescale. It's very almost bureaucratic, as Jan described it yesterday. And it starts at the a period called Hadean, at the very early stage of Earth's formation. And at the top left, we are now in the Holocene. Now, life, of course, is a bit more complicated than that, as you all know. The Anthropocene is something that is a very complex phenomenon. It's something that is influenced by the Earth as it is, by our consciousness that is now getting in the way, if you want, or it's getting into what used to be nature. The number of humans is a factor. The great acceleration of our consumption is a factor. The physical boundaries, like what happens if you put X tons, billion tons of CO2 into the atmosphere, is one factor. Our values and rules, the power distribution in humanity, money flows, technologies, scientific breakthroughs, biosphere reaction to what we do. It's not that humans are the masters of the Anthropocene. We have Earth reacting to us. So the Anthropocene is not something where we just do things and control things. The whole Earth reacts to it. And of course, there are the many future unknowns, and they all play together and make the Anthropocene a very complex thing. Now, I have tried to interpret the Anthropocene in books. And this is a very personal interpretation I'm offering to you. The physical evidence is there. And this is one thing I think that scientists need to be totally neutral about this and actually working with a null hypothesis that the Anthropocene is not real. And they don't have to decide that this is a reality. I think they should be totally free, perhaps also to just take time. Perhaps they need another decade or two decades. For the science itself, there should be no pressure to do this. But the word is out, and it's inspiring people. That's what I find, including politicians in Germany, for example. This is the House of World Culture, which you see here in the middle. It's right next to Angela Merkel's chancellery, and it's a cultural center funded by the German government. And what was amazing that when we put together what's called the Anthropocene Project, we got the funding from the Budget Commission of the German Bundestag. So the parliamentarians, who normally don't like to spend money, as you know, in this time of austerity, they gave us money to explore the Anthropocene in a cultural setting, bringing together geologists, psychologists, sociologists, artists, technology makers. And this was a very good format to explore this phenomenon. And also at the German Technology Museum in Munich, if you happen to come to Munich over the next year or so, there's an exhibition on. You see Paul Crutzen has been to the opening, and this is on the right side. It's Achim Steiner, the head of the United Nations Environmental Program, who gave the keynote speech. And in that exhibition, we try to visualize what the Anthropocene is. Like you see the evolution of dogs here, you see the evolution of razors, a technological kind of evolution. You see a coral reef that has been put together by people who are concerned about the future, and it's like a knitted coral reef. And on the bottom right, you see Jan Salasiewicz giving his keynote speech there. Part of that exhibition is a artistic interpretation of how the future might play out. This is a plastic fossil of the future, a hypothetical plastic fossil of the future we have in the exhibition. Now, in the course of my exploration of the Anthropocene, I have come and I myself have become critical of the idea. Is it really the right thing we want to do? And I think it's a very good thing if the Anthropocene is declared officially, we will be stuck with it for quite some time. Geologists will not come back and say in 50 years' time, okay, let's call it something else. So it might be something we have to live with for another 10,000 years or even more. Who knows? So we better make sure now that we think about this very much and that we explore it before it becomes formalized. So some of the criticism or the questions that come up are, is it perhaps anthropocentric? Is it not really reflecting the diversity of life on the planet enough? But is it too much focusing on human agency? Is it perhaps something that is going to be used as a tool of entitlement? So we own the Earth. The Earth is ours, and we can do with it what we want. Or is it a synonym for techno-fixes, like geoengineering, for example? Or does it blur responsibility for climate change? If you look at the word anthropos, every human being is an anthropos. And if you say all the anthropos feed into the climate change, for example, problems, then that's wrong, because there's a big difference between somebody who lives in India and somebody who lives in the US or the UK or Germany in terms of how much you contribute to climate change. So if you say all anthropos are in this equally, it's actually not true. Then there is this interpretation that the Anthropocene is the sum of all environmental problems. And that what is really very disconcerting for me, because if we live with it for a long time, we shouldn't define it as like a nightmare. A sum of all environmental problems would mean that this reflects really just very badly on our species. So the big question for me is there a possibility for a good Anthropocene? We will leave footsteps, footprints on the surface of planet Earth and the subsurface and the oceans, the atmosphere. We are doing this already. My question is, can we make these footprints more beautiful, more productive, more diverse? Can we move towards a better geological record? What I see as a big service of the Anthropocene idea that it is expanding our sense of time. We are now stuck between nanosecond trading, which is controlling the flow of billions of dollars around the globe right now, and the doomsdayism of the environmental movement. So these are two time concepts that are really quite contrary, but they're kind of playing together. What we really need is a feeling for the long now, a feeling how when you get into your car, you interact with the deep past 300 million years ago when the oil was formed, you're burning, and the deep future, 50,000 years into the future, because the carbon molecules that go through the car will cause climate change still in 10,000 years. Hinduism has been a bit better at long-term thinking. This is the clock of the long now at the Science Museum here. Western culture tries to catch up. And I think the Anthropocene is a very good vector for long-term thinking, conveying a sense of a beginning, not an end. A challenge I see posed by the Anthropocene is that our civilization becomes nature in a sense, and we need cities that think like a planet. We can't rely anymore on this Holocene situation that we just extract resources from this big environment around us and then dump our waste into it. Now, in this Anthropocene period, everything comes back. And if you have a city like here in China, top left, that is 1,000 kilometers long, this is a new nature. It's a geological concoction because of all the materials brought together to build the city, like this brick here, and the glass and the steel and so on. And it's also something that needs to function like an ecosystem. So this is an image from Florida, which nicely shows this sort of natural appearance of our civilizational structures. I think what we need is things like a bog here, that a new bog created in the middle of the city that functions like a liver of the city, or urban gardening that produces the food of the city, renewable energies right in the city, and, for example, cycling highways that make our transport system more sustainable. Anthropocene challenge also is to turn our agriculture into an ecosystem, because we now grow food and raise animals on an area the size of South America, and even more than that. And here's the case for recarbonization. We always talk about decarbonization, but what we do is we drag the carbon out of the soil. We cause erosion, creating the Anthropocene markers. And this is something that must stop. Like deforestation is something that connects your plate to the deep rainforest. And you see here how our modern agriculture plays out, or this pig farm here in the United States, where the nitrogen I talked about is nicely concentrated. And Anthropocene agriculture, for me, would be something that acts, again, like an ecosystem. This is the former German border, east-west German border, where the wall ran. And luckily, it developed a nice green space, and it now forms the longest nature reserve in Europe, which is a nice thing. And I think we should have these genetic highways, in a way, run through our landscape and form an agricultural nature. The same holds true for our technology. We have now 1 billion cars. We have billions of smartphones and everything. And they are a geological phenomenon. So if you hold your iPhone to your ear, you have 40 different mountains connecting with you, because the iPhone is made up of 40 elements from 40 different mines around the world. And it's something we need to make compostable. We need to integrate the technosphere into the biosphere. And there's this nice sentence here from James Scott. He says, the larger the pile of rubble you leave behind, the larger your place in the geological record, right? So this is, at the moment, the Anthropocene feeling that we pile up this amazing amount of rubble that is then used as the marker. But can it get better? Do we really need to extract resources again and again? Do we really need to fill the oceans with plastic? This is a big question. Now here, you see robots developed by DARPA, the U.S. research agency, which are now used by Google. This kind of could be a futuristic vision where animals like that collect environmental data, feed them back into a very intelligent system that is used to run our economy in a more sustainable way. Anthropocene challenge number 5 for me is to build a real sharing economy. And the word has been misused, I think, by companies like Uber and Airbnb. It's now used as a more form of micro-capitalism. But think about the number of people who now strive to live like on a material level, like we have enjoyed it in Europe and the US for such a long time. And this is something that is impossible. So we have to get to a situation where we start multiplying our own lifestyles times the number of people and then see what is still possible and then not fight for the resources but share them. And one of the resources we need to share is the atmosphere and its capability to provide us with a climate system that is suitable for human civilization. And this directly leads to another challenge, which is becoming energy smart, because at the moment we are really energy stupid. If you look at the waste, if you look at when you go to the US, you get into rooms that are cooled down to 15 degrees Celsius and people turn blue. It's something that is just not really smart. And efficiency is very important. Saving energy is very important. But efficiency can take you only so and so far. As you can see here, this is a question, how do you get this more out of the same resources? And the question is, what happens if this sheep walks a little bit in the direction of the cliff? And I think that efficiency is super important, but we need real more innovation, deep innovation. The International Energy Agency has identified a research gap in energy research of $100 billion a year. And this is a very conservative organization. It's not a green NGO or something. So here's a guy in Denmark, Henrik Stisdal, who started the Danish wind industry and has become the chief technology officer of Siemens. There's a lot of innovation in a wind farm. Here's a fusion reactor that's currently being built in Germany, and we need to put much more money into energy research. Another facet, of course, of the Anthropocene is the way we create new life forms. And this is something that is almost natural to us because we've been breeding animals and we've been cultivating plants for 10,000 years now. The big question is, how do we do this in the future? So we diminish biodiversity by cutting the rainforest, but we also increase biodiversity through means of technology and agriculture. Question is, do these organisms we bring forth, do they reflect an attitude of stewardship, or are they just mere reflections of short-term capitalist interests? This is a synthetic organism that's been built in Craig Venter's lab in the United States. Fascinating research. An organism that's been put together almost molecule by molecule, just reflecting the sheer power of our species. Anthropocene has our species in its name. But I think it will be something that makes us more open to all other life forms we share this planet with and to make us connect. Because what it does, it puts human history into natural history. So we have now historians looking into human history and we have biologists looking into Earth history. The Anthropocene brings these two spheres together in a wonderful way and makes them one. And this allows a kind of rooting of human history in Earth history. And I think the sense of connection that will grow from this can be very helpful. My two kids here in a shopping mall in Berlin, I think that is, in terms of a sense of connectedness, really important that our kids relate to the oceans and the forests, not just through glass, as my kids do now here. Now, something I know that's very close to the heart of Tony, of course, is the question to make the economy a subset of ecology. Because really, when economists say nature is an externality, that's sheer madness. I don't know what kind of planet they talk about when they say that. So the fact that something we live from, that nourishes us, that makes us safe, like a forest, like the system of bogs, like the oceans, has no value in economy, no internal value. It's just plain wrong. And I think we need to make sure that in an Anthropocene economy, things are put in the right dimension, that not the money that is algorithmically multiplied in computers somewhere in the financial centers is more important to us than what we actually live from. And I would call Kew Gardens the real central bank of this country, for example. And you know what happened with Kew Gardens in the last year. I think the Anthropocene offers us a good chance to link our personal lifestyles with these big phenomena you read about in the media. And this is my kitchen table here. We have this little planet in the back here, and it's a talking planet. If you hold a pen to it, it gives you information about planet Earth, languages spoken, heights of the mountains, and so on. So I dream of having a planet there that kind of tells me what the food that I put on the table does to it. That would be a really nice app. Also, I think it's a good time to develop new cultural practices, like the ones I've seen here on the Indonesian island of Bali, where there are daily offerings to make sure that things run smoothly. When I came back there, I looked at my waste bin at home, and I thought, is this my daily offering to planet Earth? Is this what I give back to planet Earth? So I think we need new kind of rituals. And one idea perhaps would be to pronounce something like, you know that there is Earth Day once a year, okay, where people switch off lights and everything and pretend to be interested in the environment and everything. So perhaps we should do it the other way around. Perhaps we should create something like Earth Destruction Day, where once a year we can do anything we like. We can put toxins in the water. We can go shoot the rarest animals and everything and just let our aggressions run free. But 364 days a year, we do the new Anthropocene normal. And I would think if we do it the other way around, it would be a sign of a better civilization. Also, the Anthropocene, I think, can help to just activate us because it really focuses how big the problems are we face. And the climate march, for example, which you see here in New York, is a good example that it helps serve activation. Already Ban Ki-moon has used the word to open an environmental summit. He said he opened it last year with the sentence, "Welcome to the Anthropocene." So I have two more challenges. One is that the internet we are building, which becomes the kind of backbone of the way we communicate, needs to be more than a commercial thing and actually more than a human thing. I think there's a big challenge there to develop it into an internet of all things. We now talk about the internet of things, which means fridges and cars and commercial products, mainly, only. So how can we create an internet that brings in the interests of the other life forms we share planet Earth with and perhaps is smart enough to help us compute what future inhabitants of Earth might want us to do or not? Because that's a very difficult thing to decide, what is good for future generations. My last Anthropocene challenge I want to put out is revitalizing materialism, because we call ourselves a materialistic culture, and this is, we are blaming ourselves for being materialistic. But are we really? Are we really when we buy the things and then throw them away on the next day? And when things get constructed in a way that they get kaput, to use a German word, within 2 years or 3 years. So we buy new things. So we are more of a turnover society, not a materialistic society. This is an artwork which you can see in October Gallery here in London by an artist called El Anouchi. And he's from Africa, from Ghana. And he has used metal caps from bottles and turned it into a wonderful, wonderful piece of art, many wonderful pieces of art. And this reflects our ability to create wonderful new things from old things and give them a new value also. This is a plant I encountered in the deep rainforest of Indonesia. And when I was there, I felt like this is untouched nature. And then I realized, no, it's touched nature, because it could be that one of the carbon molecules that went through my life, like when I drove a car, has ended through the atmospheric connections, has ended up in this plant. And this is the future, that all we do permeates all life on Earth, not only with the plastic particles, but much more deep than that. So in a way, nature becomes culture, because what we do is everywhere. And it's the other way around. Culture can become nature, as you see here. This is Glass Beach in California. And for decades, the local community dumped old bottles there. Now, the ocean did a wonderful job at rounding it up and turning it into such a wonderful thing here. So it's now a nature reserve. People come there and pick glass, and they now talk about replenishing it. So it's a nature reserve where we might actually dump waste in order to have this wonderful effect here. So I formulated 12 challenges, and the complexity of them, I think, reflects that the Anthropocene is much more than climate change. Climate change certainly is the most pressing issue. But the Anthropocene reflects that everything that happens on planet Earth is changing at the moment. Humans have become the dominant force of change, and we need to make sure that we understand this process and perhaps try to get a little bit ahead of it. An overarching concern I have is the question of democracy in the Anthropocene. How do we reflect the interests of future generations? And most importantly, how do we reflect the interests of the weakest, like this boy here on an electronic waste dump in Ghana? How does that feed into our democratic decision-making? And how do we make sure we are not run by what is now called a plutocracy? How do we make sure that the weakest have a voice in this Anthropocene? But I'm optimistic, because we can build machines that simulate the Big Bang. We can create structures looking like flowers on a nanometer scale, which is an amazing feast of science Harvard University has managed to do. And we can afford to send astronauts into space and then getting tweets back from them saying how much they enjoyed a tomato that was sent up to them, how precious one piece of fruit, of vegetable, is when they get an apple or a tomato, is to them when they are up in space. And when the German astronaut, came back from the International Space Station, the first thing he said when he left his spaceship was, "Earth smells beautiful." And I think this is a very precious observation. This is something we should keep in mind when we go into this new geological epoch, which is a process, as Jürgen Renn, the science historian, has said, that reflects about itself. It's an open thing. It's not an ideology. It's something we are in together. It's something that now has many negative connotations, but it's something where we should make sure that the positive connotations become more, that it's an emerging thing that becomes positive day by day, as this wonderful piece of art has formulated here. Thank you very much, and I look forward to your questions and the discussion with Tony first. Thanks.
Christian, thank you for that marvellous and very stimulating presentation. You covered an enormous amount of ground there, and I think you've given everybody a really good rounded view of what this new concept means for us, many challenges at many different levels. One thing that strikes me about this is the implications of when we say the Anthropocene started. So there's quite a lot of big scientific brains at the moment devoting a lot of effort to working out when the beginning of this period starts and when the end of the Anthropocene occurred. Do you have any reflections on that in terms of the importance of answering that question in the right way?
Yes. I think what is really important for the science is that it needs to be a global signal that is used as a starting point for the Anthropocene, and it needs to be a long-lasting signal. So the hope would be that if a hypothetical geologist, comes back in, let's say, 100,000 years or a million years, he can still measure it. He can still say, this is what defined the Anthropocene. So one example of that, of course, would be the nuclear explosions that started in the 1940s. And that would be creating, that created the nuclear fallout and everything that is measurable for a long time. And this is together with the great wave of plastic production, at the moment the favorite of the geological community to use that. Right. An alternative would be to go further back in time, but I think in order to reflect the sheer power of the Anthropocene, it would be perhaps more advisable to take a more recent date, let's say the 1945 or 1950, to make clear that this is when things became really global, really powerful, and also really dangerous.
I think the plastic point is actually quite an interesting one if one looks at the so-called KT boundary. Yeah. And the impacts of that meteorite that hit the Earth 65 million years ago, wiping out the dinosaurs.
Right.
And one of the reasons, as I understand it, the geologists pinpointed that particular time in Earth's history is because of a layer of iridium that covers the entire planet, which was a result of that impact. And one wonders if we might be heading towards a point where future geologists will be able to detect a layer of plastic covering the entire Earth.
And this already happens.
Which is already happening. So maybe there's something in there which sends a signal as well to people, because that would instantly connect us now to the Anthropocene rather than leaving it as some distant previous event, maybe the extinction of the Pleistocene megafauna when people were killing saber-toothed cats and mammoths. Some people, I guess, would say that could be a time when it started.
There's debate about that. Yeah.
Right through to the 1940s or 50s. One thing that strikes me as being less about the science, but which would have major implications arising from that scientific discussion, is the way in which people might debate the Anthropocene from the point of view of what should be done.
Right.
And you can imagine some people maybe in the climate change denial camp saying, well, if the Anthropocene started 20,000 years ago, why worry? Because we've had urbanization and agriculture since then. Everything is fine. Civilization has risen up. And actually, it's a good thing. Whereas if it's in the much more recent past, you might say, actually, we're entering a period of crisis because of this turning point that occurred maybe half a century ago.
Yes, well, Paul Crutzen certainly would not support any idea that the Anthropocene should be seen as a benign thing or something that we shouldn't worry about. Quite the opposite. In the very early papers he formulated with Will Steffen and others, there was a description that the Anthropocene is something where we need to strive to enter a phase of stewardship. And so any climate change denier should not really use the word Anthropocene in the sense that we can do anything, because the originator of the idea, at least, really wanted it to be a thing that reflects stewardship.
Absolutely. Right? And so you just reminded me of a marvelous quote that I wrote down yesterday from Edward Wilson, the great American biologist, and he said, "We stumbled into the 21st century with Stone Age emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technologies." And you put those three things together, and you're kind of struck by the extent to which we are ill-equipped to be able to move into this new phase of human history and to embrace this new period in a positive way. I just wonder what your view would be in terms of where would be the most productive places to begin to shape the debate. Would it be in the science? Would it be in politics? Mm-hmm. Is it in philosophy? Mm-hmm. Is it in art? Is it in economics? Mm-hmm. All of the above, I'm sure. But where would you put yourself?
What we tried in Berlin is bring together all of the agents, if you want, that you mentioned, because as I try to show, it's the complexity of it needs that. But what I feel is that, I mean, we both work in journalism, and we really try hard to provide the public with facts and figures, right? And we've been doing that on the climate front, if you want to call it like that.
Yes.
We've been doing that for how long now? So facts alone really don't need. So I would actually identify the area of culture and associate with emotions as a more important arena, perhaps more important even than the economy, because ultimately we are social beings, we are emotional beings, and if on a larger scale that sinks in on that level, that will cause changes on all other levels. So I would hope that's what happens.
And I certainly would agree with this, and the extent to which over time, and my personal experience of engaging with the sustainability discussion and the doom-laden narrative that sometimes comes with some of the environmental debates, the extent to which the science tends to confuse people. And then on the other side, the way in which you can increasingly see through the reactions to that, how sustainability and the good Anthropocene is going to have to be based first and foremost on beauty, it seems to me.
Yeah.
And your glass beach there, I think, at the end, is really quite a profound signal as to how that fusion between human impacts and nature needs to be something we can paint a picture of and build more of as we go forward. And that's quite interesting when you look at the extent to which the worlds of art, activism and science hardly talk to each other.
Yeah, and the environmental community often, unfortunately, comes across as pretty sour. Yes. And pretty frugal. And I think if it wants to be a celebration of life on Earth, yes. You know, we should perhaps, I mean, there's this conference of the parties, as they say, yes. of the United Nations when the climate summit comes together, like in Paris at the end of the year. They say it's the conference of the parties of the climate contract, but I always think it would be better to have a party of the conference. I've been to a lot of these summits, and they are all very bureaucratic, very boring events. And why not have a global, nice party there where people really connect on a different level, right? Perhaps then we would get a climate treaty at the end of such a conference, right?
I think you might be right, having been to a lot of those myself. So,
and the food always is horrible. That's something
too.
I've talked about agriculture. You spend a week in a conference center with sloppy sandwiches and stuff. At the end, you just want it to end. So I think it would be really good to have wonderful food there from all over the world and to celebrate food there. To make it a thing that is sensual and rich and diverse and everything. So I think the United Nations should really start with the food, and perhaps then we would get a good climate contract.
Well, the next one, happily, is in France.
Yes,
so
that's great.
Start.
Wonderful.
So,
see, that's hope for the planet.
Really.
Yes, that's hope for the planet.
So on that note, Christiane, of celebration rather than catastrophe and seeing the Anthropocene as an opportunity to forge this new positive relationship with the Earth and with each other, let's go to the floor. We have about 15 minutes for reflections and questions.
Is the way forward to make the public accept the importance of looking after the environment to look at their selfish nature, the selfish nature of human beings? For example, you might put up a solar panel if it's going to slash your electricity bill. But you might not be too worried about helping the environment. Is that a way forward?
Yes. I mean, the incentives which are offered by governments to citizens, they are egotistical in a sense by nature. You make, for example, governments make fossil fuels cheaper than they are with subsidies of 500 billion euros annually. I mean, dollars annually. This is incredible. So if oil is artificially subsidized, then of course people who, in an egotistical way, if you can only be egotistical about that if the oil is really expensive, and then it is good for you to save it, right? So I think this on this incentive level is really important. But on the other hand, are we really that egotistical as a species? I wonder. It's always something we say, and capitalism certainly rests on that assumption. But I view us not as an egotistical species per se. We are a very social one. If we had been egotists through our history, we would not be here. We are only here because we are a social species, and that's actually our power.
Indeed. Now, you just reminded me of something else you said earlier on, which I think does raise, alongside the other questions we've discussed, the extent to which economics is the core of this and the way in which we are diminishing our propensity to cooperate through having explicit agendas for competition. It's everywhere. We want to enhance our competitiveness. The policy environment is established to increase competition. Is that changing the way we think, do you think, and blocking this particular way in which we might unleash
absolutely.
Potential?
I mean, think of climate change. I mean, at the very beginning, the whole negotiations, they were framed as what was called burden sharing. So the whole climate process was set up as something where you try to push the burden to the other side of the table, right? And this is why China, America, Europe sits there, and everybody tries to push things across the table to the other party concerned, right? So when you develop the whole thing as a sharing exercise, for example, by defining first the capacity of the atmosphere to take up CO2 on a level that still makes the climate run like we want it, or you create business opportunities from saving CO2, right? Then the whole thing becomes more of a cooperative thing. Or energy research is a very good example where it's only working on a cooperative level. So, yes, the kind of egotism metaphor is very detrimental, I think.
Thank you. My name is Malcolm Aiken, and I've lost my voice. You had a discussion between you about the beginning and whether it was very recent or how far back you could push it, which is interesting. And in essence, psychological or emotional reasons for making it recent rather than in the distant past. I think the much more interesting question is, when's it going to end? How's it going to end? And how can we stop it ending? Mm. Because that's much more emotionally engaging.
Mm-hmm. Right. Thank you.
But I think the first, it's a very important point you make. And what the Anthropocene does first is create this kind of window into that deep future. Because on the one hand, there is this total short-termism of our economic and also political system. And then there is this apocalyptic wall we run against. Like in 2050, if we don't cut the carbon emissions, it's like the end of the world. And so the Anthropocene makes... Yes, exactly, a very short thing. And so the Anthropocene idea kind of opens that up in a nice way. The thing is, Jan Salasiewicz, this chief Anthropocene scientist, yesterday said, even if humanity was to kind of mysteriously vanish from the planet tomorrow, it would still be something that would really characterize Earth for a long time, all the changes I tried to present to you. So even then. But it's this openness and it's this future orientation, because environmentalism often is backward-oriented, like nostalgic about things. I think this future orientation is very healthy about it. And it will end when the human influence is diminishing to a point where something else becomes stronger. And who knows, perhaps one day the last human being will be kept in a wonderful nature reserve by some other life form and will be looked after, hopefully in a very nice way, like we look after the rare species of today. I don't know. Or we take the Anthropocene to other planets, perhaps. Also a possibility, which is already hinted at by the suns we put on comets and the stuff that's on Mars and so on. So, yeah, the nice thing is that we don't know and we need to develop a culture of not knowing, really.
For me, the question is who is really pulling the strings? Huh? You mentioned just once on your lecture there capitalism. There are vast... does sound awfully negative, but there are vast amounts of fossil reserves, fuel reserves in this planet that I'm sure all the companies want to bring out and use.
Yeah.
These companies, these organisations have phenomenal power, lobbying power, and I know what you're expressing is goodwill and it's altruistic, and I just wonder, you know, how we combat that. So, you know, the climate change kind of forums you were there at, obviously the food was absolutely horrible, but also the results weren't all that brilliant
no,
either.
No, absolutely, I agree.
You know, I'm not trying to make that connection, but I do feel...
No, Well, the power question, I think, is incredibly important. And I gave you that number of $500 billion in global subsidies for fossil fuels worldwide. People think that renewable energies get so much subsidies. Renewable energies only get $100 billion, five times less than the subsidies for fossil fuels. Now, of course, that reflects the power structure. And I think this is where it needs to start. It's the incentive side, the subsidy side. And then the power structures, hopefully, will also change. And it is power is a big question. Will we live in an Anthropocene where, like, these famous 90 people who own, 50% of wealth, right, run the Anthropocene? Or will it be... and perhaps a rejuvenation of real democracy here. And if we allow nature, as Tony wonderfully describes in his books, nature to become an economic factor, then, you know, power will decentralize. What is happening with renewable energy now in places like Denmark or Germany, that they decentralize power over electricity. In Germany, we had the four big electricity companies. Now you have tens of thousands of contributors. And that's already sort of decentralizing power in a very nice way, and I think that should be an example. So,
thank you. For a start, I love that this debate is happening at the RSA. Do you think, for all practical purposes, now it seems I was at the talk at the Royal Institution last night with a real kind of scientific background and theme, that it would be beneficial and helpful for humanity's future to separate slightly the debate and discussion about defining the Anthropocene as a frame of reference from the purely geological standpoint and from the field to, you know, a broader and more comprehensive, incisive
place in human thought and sense and perspectives, to include its relevance as a philosophical concept, as a cultural anthropological concept and construct, yeah. And also in terms of politics and business.
I think what needs to be done is that the scientists who are concerned with the official bureaucratic process of formalizing making it official, that they are not under pressure from a very lively political debate, and they needs to be absolutely certain that they can look at the evidence and just, you know, take their time. I don't think there needs to be an artificial separation. And actually, the Anthropocene Working Group has been involved in our Berlin project, and they've all enjoyed it because they see this is something new for geologists as well. I mean, they've been used to looking into the distant past, and it's been it's a wonderful science, but it's much easier to look at something that has happened 100 million years ago than try and make sense of something that is happening right now, right? So they see also that geology itself as a science has entered a new period where perhaps they need to open up to the humanities, for example, to understand what sort of rocks are forming on Earth, you know? How get minerals distributed, like the phosphorus we use or the lithium we bring from concentrated places here and spread them globally. This is happening through our shopping behavior, right? So suddenly shopping becomes a factor of geology, of the future geology of this planet. So I don't think there needs to be an artificial separation. Yeah. Just needs to make sure the scientists can work and not be pressured by politics or society, right?
Thank you, Christian. The gentleman here, please. This is all male so far, so feel free to put your hands up if you're not male.
Yeah, it's not the age of men, I have to say.
Yes, exactly. Yes, don't read into this Anthropocene thing any kind of gender bias, please.
I like the concept of the good Anthropocene and trying to make sure that while humans are the dominant species, we are taking that long-term view and thinking of our impact on the planet. But coming back to the question of how long it might last, as an RSA fellow, I was sitting here in the RSA about a year ago, listening to an Oxford professor telling us that by the end of this century, artificial intelligence will have reached the point where human beings are becoming redundant. So maybe part of our focus should be on preparing for that stage and how we leave the planet for the machines that might possibly take over.
Yeah, I can tell you, sir, I just wrote a story on artificial intelligence for German Geo magazine, and I visited one of the researchers in Switzerland who's been behind developing artificial intelligence, and his work is in a lot of what Google and Facebook at the moment does, the algorithms he wrote. Now, his vision actually is totally different, and I share your concern, and this is certainly something we need to think about, but he thinks that the machines of the future, for them, Earth will not be that interesting. It's wet, so they like rust, and it's limited, you know. So they will want to go to the asteroid belt where there are enough resources and multiply themselves there, while Earth is then left to humans. I don't really share into this. It's just interesting to see that people think about scenarios like that, and certainly artificial intelligence. And again, that's artificial intelligence will be a power question. Who is controlling it? Is it something we are all in together? And perhaps it wonderfully connects natural intelligence, human intelligence, artificial intelligence? Or is it a means by which we are controlled, by which we are basically run, you know? And the Anthropocene of artificial intelligence would be very geological. Machines are geological concoctions. But I wouldn't want to live in a world like that. We need to make sure that artificial intelligence is become a more of a part of the internet of all beings. That would be actually a great thing. Please.
Gentleman here, please.
Thank you. Speaking for a female voice, obviously Naomi Klein's recent book called This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate, points a very, very damning finger at capitalism as a force. And it's, your talk to me suggests the idea that the Holocene is being brought to an end by unfettered capitalism, and the Anthropocene is the corrective measures which are going to be taken by artificial intelligence and more refined ideas about how we manage ourselves as a species. Do you think there's something in that?
Yeah, and I heard researchers suggesting it should be called the Capitalocene, right? But that would imply that the current capitalism stays with us for another 10,000 years. So I'm a big fan of the free market and all of that, but I think the way it's framed, it's with a total blindness to the natural values, for example, with a lack of a sense of time. We are controlling space on the surface of Earth perfectly, but we have no sense of time of long term in that system. So I think I would have loved Naomi Klein to come up with really. I reviewed her book for the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung. I enjoyed the first part. I would have loved her to come up with even more radical ideas. I think it's a really good book, take it further. What are the economic alternatives? That would have been really good. And the Anthropocene is a big call for indeed. Alternative forms of
indeed, capitalism. And also maybe to dig beneath the specific criticisms of capitalism and to maybe think through what might have happened had socialism prevailed as the global economic order. And you look at what happened in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, it was even worse than the capitalist impacts on the environment.
Absolutely.
One wonders whether there's something far deeper beneath our economic system, as you were saying, which is more about the philosophical relationship we have with planet Earth rather than the economic system we invent to organise ourselves and to create wealth and everything else. And it does then run straight into that question of if not capitalism, then what?
Yep.
And I think, you know, quite a lot of people on the left side of politics thinks that socialism would automatically be greener. I'm not so sure that's the case. Well, the opposition parties in this country, with the exception of the Greens, they don't really talk about this stuff at all.
No, it's just, I think, a good point. I think Naomi describes wonderfully. I mean, she's very honest about that. And she describes wonderfully that this is the challenge to develop an economic model that is free, based on freedom, human freedom, and on the questions of sustainable development at the same time. And I think her book is a great call to do that.
Yes, indeed. No, the way I would look at it is to say that the job at hand really is to fuse ecology and economics rather than to have one parasitizing and cannibalizing the other, which is what's going on at the moment. And you can invent any economic system you like, but if it's not embedded in ecology, with ecology being seen as the bigger envelope, then it's not going to work. And maybe this is the opportunity for the Anthropocene to be able to frame that conversation.
Yeah.
We have time for one more. Let's go right here, please. So another man, sorry about that.
I can talk in a different voice. We're talking about a whole series of different ideas here, and intelligence is part of this too. If we think about the biosphere, which we all now understand, we've talked about the technosphere. These are all terms that really come in the late 19th century and the early 20th century. One thing that hasn't been mentioned is actually the most complex of them all. It's this idea of the noosphere. Now, if you read the Vernadsky seems to be talking about there is the intelligence of the major species on the planet now, obviously mankind. There's mankind's intelligence. We've just heard that artificial intelligence may well come to the fore. But what's not really being said is that Vernadsky also talks about what he calls the biological intelligence, the planetary intelligence.
Yep.
Now, this is the thing that nobody really talks about, and one of the reasons is that we don't know very much about it.
Mm.
Biology is its own science. All the sciences are all in their own little compartments. We talk about geology. They're having great difficulty talking about the politics and the culture and so on and so forth. Vernadsky talks about the planetary intelligence. He talks about this thing. Lovelock called it Gaia. Vernadsky wasn't necessarily going that far to anthropomorphize it. But the reality as I see it is that the current scientific debate isn't capable of understanding that there might be other kinds of intelligence.
But it's
that nature has its own way of moving. And putting itself in relationship to that, just as Tony was saying, we need to understand what it is that we're trying to become.
But I think science is on a good path, actually. Like in brain science, if you look at what the Allen Institute in Seattle does, which is one of the, privately, $1 billion privately funded brain research, they explore this exactly what you say, this sort of intelligence or consciousness question in other beings. And I mean, this whole metaphor of other beings are like machines. That's what science has been running with for 200, 300 years now, since Descartes, right? This is, I think, over. And we I think Anthropocene brain science will be something that makes us aware that what we now see as something that is only human, with the consciousness and everything, is much more distributed in nature. And again, increase that sense of connectedness. So, well, the nice thing about science is it's always the current state of not knowing things, right? And so really, it's wonderful to think that we might know only 0.1% of what is knowable at the moment. And there is this vast world around us. And the Anthropocene, I think, is just a very nice framework for that exploration.
I'm afraid we've run out of time. We've had a very short time on this huge subject. I think we could have gone on all day, but I think Christian has given us a very rich body of thoughts based around this big idea, ranging from the nature of economic ideology through to the nature of intelligence. We've touched on art and geology. I don't think I've been in many conversations that have done that in under an hour. So thank you very much for that.
Well, thank you.
Let's just finish by thanking Christian Schlegel for his incredibly powerful thoughts on the Anthropocene. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.